And Saudi leaders called on that Saudi-led coalition to stop the siege and its aggression, stressing Yemen will not accept any form of Western hegemony. And a national mourning in Iraq for victims of a wedding fire in the Iraqi city of Hamdaniya, which has been blamed on a lack of safety standards of the reception hall. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran has successfully launched a new satellite into orbit amid strict sanctions imposed by Western states aimed at crippling the Islamic Republic's peaceful space program. The Telecom's minister has confirmed the Noor 3 imaging satellite has been placed into orbit of 450 kilometers above Earth. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has carried out the launch using homegrown satellite carrier Qasid. The Aerospace Division of the IRGC launched the first Iranian military satellite, the Noor 1, in April of 22 and the Noor 2 in March of 2022. This as Washington imposed strict sanctions on Iran's civilian space agency in 2019, alleging it is used to advance Tehran's ballistic missile program. Iran has time and again denied seeking nuclear weapons, stressing its space program, like its nuclear program, is purely for non-military purposes. Our correspondent Gisumi Shah Ahmadi earlier joined us with more details on the Noor 3 satellite launch.
This is a great achievement for Iran, considering the fact, Badia, that Iran is under harsh sanctions. So seeing the country thrive in so many fields, in high-tech fields in particular, is actually great news for Iranians, and the entire Iranian nation is happy today to hear about this. This is something that always comes to mind whenever we witness some great achievement in Iran, considering the fact that Iran has been under U.S. sanctions since beginning of the Islamic Revolution, since 1979. So basically what I'm trying to say is that for Iranians as a nation, it's very difficult to have access to anything high-tech. These sanctions are so harsh that in many cases they even include medicine and food. So the fact that you see Iran achieving these heights in high-tech fields like aerospace, there are only a handful of countries who actually have the technology, who actually have conquered space. So, something interesting, Badia, you have to note that many of these countries have done so with the help of the pioneers. The countries like Russia and the United States or Western countries have helped them with that. But the thing about Iran is that its own achievements, it has achieved this with the help of its own scientists, that Iran is standing on its own two feet. And that is what makes this achievement even more important and even more significant.
Iranian officials have time and again criticized Western states for what they see as a hybrid war against the Islamic Republic following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Researcher David Miller, who's also a former Bristol University academic, has traveled to Iran to investigate this issue. Miller visited Iran to personally see things taking place on the ground. He spoke to ordinary people and intellectuals about various issues, most specifically the role of the West throughout Iran's history. Miller particularly investigated the role that the UK has played in Iran, from interfering in the country's affairs before the Islamic Revolution to measures conducted after the revolution. Outcome of his research has been presented in a documentary dubbed Decolonization of the Mind, aired on Press TV. We earlier joined by David Miller, academic broadcaster and producer of Decolonization of the Mind documentary, and he told us more about his motives for producing the program.
Well, I came to Iran in March, and one lives in the West, one sees a constant drumbeat of propaganda against Iran. Only last week at the UN General Assembly, we saw the ambassador of the Zionist entity, Gilad Erdan, trying to interrupt the speech of President Raisi. And amongst the things he was saying there and posing outside with Iranian opposition, the murder of Mahsa Amini, which sparked off this series of protests last year. But everybody knows who's looked at this that Mahsa Amini was not murdered by the Iranian state, and indeed by anybody. And so what we see is a constant diet of propaganda. And I was aware of this. I've been studying propaganda in Ireland, in Iraq, in Afghanistan for 30 years now. And so I was aware of this, but I wanted to come to see Iran for myself and see, try and get a sense myself of what the country was like, and provide, as a result of that, an indication of how the country in reality differs from the drumbeat of lies which one gets in the Western media.
And we discussed speech of leader Yemen's answer to the movement earlier with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
Time now for the news review. There's this bulletin. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reiterated that his country will not accept any form of Western hegemony. Abdul Malik al-Houthi urged the Saudi-led coalition to stop the aggression and crippling siege. He argued that the aggression meant to prevent the formation of an independent government in Yemen that does not abide by foreign diktats. Houthi also warned of plots hatched by Yemen's enemies to divide the country. Meanwhile, he reiterated Yemen's support for the Palestinian resistance, condemning any form of normalization with the Israeli regime. Abdul Malik al-Houthi made the remarks in a speech on the occasion of the birth anniversary of Islam's Prophet Muhammad that was marked by huge nationwide rallies in Yemen. Yusuf Mowry is our correspondent, joining us from Sana'a. Hossein Abukhaiti is an activist and political commentator who also joins us from Sana'a. Welcome to you both. Yusuf Mowry, first to you. That was a huge turnout that happened. It was quite incredible, actually, when you take a look at the images that came through. Tell us about that and, of course, highlights that you deem important.
Thousands of Yemenis who took to the streets just here in the capital, Sana'a, and millions of Yemenis who took to the streets in a number of provinces to commemorate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. The speech that was made today was very specific by the leader of the revolution, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi. He directed his talk to let the Western powers know that Yemen is in the process of forming an independent, sovereign Yemeni government that will not cater to any foreign influence in Yemeni land. And that's the problem with Western nations. They seem to have a problem with countries who want to establish independence from Western hegemony. And the military effort, the political effort, the revolutionary effort that this revolution from day one set out to accomplish is to bring an end to Saudi and U.S. and Western meddling in Yemen's internal affairs. And the supporters of the event today, they expressed condemnation at the Saudi-led coalition, and specifically to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, for normalizing ties with Israel and for also denigrating his society, denigrating Saudi society.
Thank you for that. So let's break some of that down, actually. Hossein Abukhaiti, the first being the fact that we saw not only Yemenis have endured this war, which recently they marked the anniversary of the revolution, but also the fact that they are in talks right now. And our correspondent there talks about how, Yemenis want their nation to be free of Western influence, of hegemons. How much of that do you think is realistic, given the fact that they're talking to Saudi Arabia, which apparently, but I think you'll agree, is somewhat supported by the West, in particular the U.S. Will these talks yield the results that the Yemenis deserve and aspire to?
I think this talks directly with Saudi Arabia was one of the few left option to end the war, because we remember when Sana'a delegation used to talk with the so-called Hadi government, or the new formed presidency of Yemen, which is located actually in Riyadh hotels, in Kuwait 1, Kuwait 2, and in Geneva and Stockholm. They haven't resulted actually in anything, because what the Saudi actually was using, the so-called legitimate legitimate government, actually to obstruct any deal. That's why to talk directly with Saudi Arabia is the best way. You don't need any middleman, because we know that these forces that's loyal to Saudi Arabia are just a tool, and they don't want Yemen to be stable. They don't want a free government, an independent government in Yemen to be formed. This is what exactly Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi have said today. And as all we have mentioned, that he hasn't actually mentioned what has happened in the recent talk with Saudi Arabia. And I believe it is clear that when he called Saudi Arabia to immediately end their war and aggression and siege against Yemen, it's a clear message that this talk actually hasn't ended really well. And I believe that if Yemeni government will take matters to strike Saudi Arabia again, I believe that Saudi Arabia will stop all its effort and will withdraw all its forces as well. The United Arab Emirates, if Sana'a will continue and resume attacks against the United Arab Emirates, they have no, the only thing they can do at that time is to withdraw from Yemen.
All right, it's a pleasure talking to you both. Yusuf Mari from Sana'a, Hussein Abukhaiti, activist and political commentator, also from Sana'a. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Massive fire engulfs a Christian wedding in Iraq's northern province of Nineveh, leaving over 100 people dead and scores injured. The fire engulfed a marriage hall in the town of Hamdaniyeh, where hundreds of guests had gathered for the event. There has been no immediate official word on the cause of this very blast, but initial reports suggest that fireworks at the venue may have sparked the flames. According to medical sources, the majority of injured suffer from burns and asphyxiation, adding there's also been crowd crushes at the scene. Civil defense officials reported that highly flammable and low-cost building materials helped the flames spread, causing parts of the ceiling to collapse. Provincial governor says death toll could rise much further. And condolences are pouring in following the deadly fire incident at the wedding in Iraq. Iraqi President Abdul Latif Rashid called for a thorough probe into the blaze and necessary measures to prevent recurrences in the future. In a statement, Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani called on ministers of health and the interior to mobilize all efforts to help the victims and their families. Most prominent Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani also offered his sympathy for the loss of lives. Iran has also offered condolences to the Iraqi government and people, especially the bereaved families. The Iraqi government has declared 3 days of national mourning. A year has passed since the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, whose perpetrators are still unknown. Investigators from around the world are still probing the incident to try to resolve the mystery. In late September last year, powerful explosions rocked the pipelines of the Nord Stream network, followed by a massive leak of fuel and unprecedented damage. Russia and several European countries called it sabotage, as the gas pipelines are at the center of an energy standoff between the West and Russia. Investigations by scientists from around the world are still being conducted. Amid all this scientific effort, distinguished American journalist Seymour Hersh has claimed that the U.S. partnered with Norway in a top-secret operation to blow up the pipelines. He argues, as Russia gained so much profit through gas and oil exports, Washington damaged the Nord Streams as a deterrent move amid the Ukraine war. White House, however, has rejected the claim. Hersh is a celebrated journalist who uncovered the 1969 My Lai massacre in Vietnam and helped expose U.S. abuses at the notorious Abu Ghraib detention center in Iraq in 2004. Moving now to the U.S. state of Washington, where people have gathered outside the Cuban embassy in solidarity following Sunday's attack on diplomatic premises. Cuban ambassador to the U.S. has condemned the incident as an act of terror. Leanna's Torres Rivera says the Molotov cocktails thrown at the embassy are part of a pattern of attacks directed at Cuba's overseas missions over the last 10 years. She stressed, however, attack cannot interrupt the embassy's work. A Cuban envoy also called on Washington to secure the embassy staff and premises to prevent similar attacks in the future. On Monday, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel condemned the attack and urged the U.S. to take action.
Hatred once again caused a terrorist attack against our embassy in Washington, an act of violence and weakness that could have cost precious lives. We denounce it and await action from the North American authorities.
Also, top Cuban diplomat Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla blasted the U.S. government, saying anti-Cuban groups in the U.S. conduct such attacks because they feel impunity. He said Havana has repeatedly warned U.S. authorities about this issue. Meanwhile, U.S. law enforcement officials said they're investigating the incident. No one has yet taken responsibility for throwing two Molotov cocktails at the embassy compound on Sunday. Activist and former U.S. presidential candidate Gloria LaRiva told us that Washington welcomes anti-Cuban terrorist attacks, and here she is.
I believe that the U.S. government actually welcomes these incidents and the long history of terrorist attacks against Cuba. Over 3,400, exactly 3,478 Cubans have died, mostly by U.S.-sponsored terrorist attacks. I would say that the greatest act of terrorism is the U.S. blockade and the recently designated so-called state sponsor of terrorism, that label that has been placed on Cuba, along with Iran, Syria, and North Korea. These are absolutely illegal designations that has created basically a siege of the island. And that siege, in addition to the blockade, has actually caused people to die from lack of medicine, from other maladies that they suffer because of the U.S. policy. So I don't think that the U.S. really cares that the embassy has been attacked.
France's ambassador to Niger leaves the country amid tensions between the two countries since the African country's new rulers took power back in July. Nigerians have hailed the departure as a significant victory for the nation and embarrassment for Paris.
It's really a very big step. We cannot say it's a complete victory yet, because we haven't seen the others leave yet. But it is a big step because it shows us that the Nigerian authorities and the Nigerian people are determined to ensure that the French leave Nigerian territory.
The French, if there is embarrassment to their people, it was caused by their president himself. They left at 4 a.m. because they knew that if they left in the middle of the day, I believe that the Nigerian people would have accompanied them to the airport.
Niger's military rulers have told the French ambassador to leave following the coup and topple the pro-France government of President Mohamed Bazoum. Since the military takeover, anti-French sentiment has been growing throughout the Sahel country, with protests being held against the presence of French troops there. Paris maintained presence in the Sahel state under the pretext of helping its former colony fight insurgency. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found that Britain's poorest families have endured a frightening collapse in their living standards over the past year as a result of soaring energy and food costs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British public broadcaster, the ITV television network, has covered this story and tells us more. According to a charity survey, more than 120,000 children in the United Kingdom are living in the most extreme form of poverty. The survey suggested the situation has worsened since last year. A rise in levels of poverty has been described as stark and worrying by Buttle UK, which works with children and young people in crisis. Its survey of 1,240 frontline professionals found that some 60% of children they work with were living in destitution, up from 45% reported the previous year and 36% in 2021. The charity, which published its annual State of Child Poverty report on Friday, 18th of August, stated, "By extension, the families our frontline workers are supporting includes approximately 122,000 children living in destitution." It added, "The year-on-year change between the last three surveys cohorts dramatically illustrates the progressively worsening circumstances for British children in poverty." The charity described the term destitution as one describing the absolute lowest standard of living any adult, child or young person can experience, adding that the lived reality is degrading and unsustainable. Social change organisation, the Joseph Rantree Foundation, defines destitution as meaning someone is going without the essentials needed to eat, to stay warm and dry, and keep clean. The charity report said someone is considered destitute if they have gone without at least two of the following in the past month: shelter, food, lighting, heat, clothing, and basic toiletries. Buttle's chief executive, Joseph Howes, said the report demonstrates the catastrophic impact of the pandemic and the cost of living crisis. The survey was open to a network frontline workers between April and May and had 1,240 responses from across England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. Some 49% said they were not able to afford their rent or equivalent. Some frontline workers reported children going to school hungry, being unable to concentrate or participate in classes, and some refusing to attend if they are noted to be different, hungry, dirty, smelly, or tired. British newspaper The Morning Star has also covered the same story and tells us more. Recently, UK's Education Secretary Gillian Keegan said pupil absences were at crisis level as she endorsed headteachers driving children to school if necessary. Figures released earlier this year showed that around 125,000 school pupils last year were severely absent, effectively meaning they were absent more often than they were in classrooms. Buttle UK, which works with children and young people in crisis, has repeatedly calls made by other organisations for the government to lift the two-child universal credit limit, which it says significantly reduces household income and well-being. It also backed calls to introduce an essential guarantee so that basic rate of universal credit at least covers the cost of life's essentials, with support never being pulled below that level, and urged the appointment of a dedicated cabinet minister for children and young people. Of the report's findings, Buttle's chief executive, Joseph Howes, said, "More and more children are having to go without food and the situation these challenges are creating are preventing them from having any chance of reaching their potential at school. The increase in children and young people living in destitution is stark and worrying." She added, a child poverty strategy is needed to support in the longer term, but changes can be made now to pull hundreds of thousands of children out from the destructive grip of poverty. She added, "We urge the government to act now and support struggling families by lifting the two-child universal credit limit and introducing an essentials guarantee, ensuring benefits always cover the basic essentials." While there is currently a Minister for Children, Families and Wellbeing, the charity said it wants to see a cabinet-level minister who can provide cross-government coordination and leadership for children, including leading on a new child poverty strategy. The Scottish broadcaster STV has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to new research, nearly one in four children in Scotland are living in poverty as campaigners call for action on unacceptably high rates. A total of 101 organisations under the End Child Poverty Coalition say all levels of government in the United Kingdom must act on the findings. According to research by Loughborough University, despite Scottish Government targets, just four local authority areas in Scotland had child poverty rates below 18% in 2021-2022. The city of Glasgow, North Ayrshire and Clackmanshire had the highest child poverty rates in Scotland, with 32%, 29% and 28.3% respectively. The statistics were calculated based on the number of children who live in a household with a median income below 60% after housing costs are removed. Child poverty rates across Scotland suggest nearly one in four children, or 24% of Scottish children, are living in poverty. John Dickey, director of the Child Poverty Action Group, made a number of recommendations to national and local governments on behalf of the End Child Poverty Coalition. The recommendations include urging the British government to scrap the two-child benefit limit, where families with additional children born after April of 2017 cannot access further financial aid, while the Scottish government should do more to mitigate the policy. The rollout of the Scottish child payment of £25 for eligible children under the age of 16 was praised by campaigners. However, they argued that ministers need to increase its value. John Dickey, director of Child Poverty Action Group, said these latest statistics are a stark reminder that child poverty remains unacceptably high across the United Kingdom, including in every local authority area in Scotland. John Dickey added, "It's now absolutely vital that the British government scraps the poverty-creating policies like the two-child limit." He said, "Here in Scotland, the Scottish child payment is already making a big difference to struggling families, but nearly one in four children still face this deep injustice, and further effort is now needed to ensure Scotland's upcoming child poverty targets are met." John Dickey added, "The First Minister has committed to use devolved powers to the absolute maximum effect, so his government must now do the right thing and go further to both increase the value of the Scottish child payment and put in place additional payments for families affected by the two-child limit." He also called for local government in Scotland to double down on child poverty action plans by putting low-income families at the centre of decision-making. Meanwhile, according to research by a children's charity, disabled British children are being forced to go without electricity or heating because their families are being disproportionately harmed by the cost of living crisis. The Childhood Trust says the rising cost of energy bills and other inflation was affecting the families of children in the United Kingdom with special educational needs and disabilities, even more than their mainstream counterparts.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is RIB English Radio. I am Asma, and here we have Sister Zainab with us. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. There's this aunt of mine. She feels like she is a good shoulder to cry on for every single person. And now, as she has got too old, she feels like whatever she has done has been just for herself, by her own side. Nobody did the same for her. And it happens to many people, I suppose, to many women out there. They feel like they are this sympathetic ear for everyone. They're this shoulder to cry on. But then nobody is there for them. I mean, sometimes having good qualities would make you feel like I'm the only one who's sharing it. I'm not getting anything in return. It's not a mutual road. It's just by me. I'm the only one who's offering it. So is it good to be everyone's sympathetic ear?
It's a quality that many possess, to be a sympathetic ear, a quality that is often seen as sometimes as a blessing and sometimes as a burden.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the perspective of life you have, depends on the beliefs you have.
Yeah.
It's not all the time bad to be a sympathetic ear. We have been taught in Islam, be empathetic, be like empathy goes beyond sympathy.
Exactly.
So we have been taught to be empathetic. Not
to put yourself in the place of the person who's talking to
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Keep yourself in the shoes of the other. Feel the pain. Be there for them. But sometimes, you know, when things go out of balance, we can't control them. Then it becomes a burden, as I said. Sometimes it's a blessing, sometimes it's a burden.
Exactly.
Like if you are being a sympathetic ear to someone just in the hopes that she will also be a sympathetic ear to me tomorrow.
In the rainy days.
Then your intention of being a sympathetic ear is really not...
It's not sheer humanity.
Right. You are just kind of... Somebody needs you, you're there for them just because you want them to be there for you tomorrow.
Yeah, just as a result of tit for tat.
Right. But it's really hard. Sometimes you are so down with the things and you want someone to hear you. What should we do in such things? What should we be doing in such cases? Shall we be, because I was a sympathetic ear to someone, shall I be expecting that now I want someone to listen to me and all? Humans will listen it human way.
Yeah.
So they will perceive things their way. You have to look for someone beyond this. Allah did not really need our prayers. It was just a pretext to make us talk to Him, to speak our heart to Him. Material of this wall, which is about to fall, will fall on my head.
Exactly.
And maybe I'll end up injuring myself. This wall, which is about to fall, are the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
Are those for whom you were a sympathetic ear.
Yeah, that,
so close
that is
to you,
very nice.
So close to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
But this firm wall that I'm telling you to rely on this wall or to sit straight back with this wall is Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wassalam.
Truly,
are the imams. Mm-hmm. If you really have a heavy heart, talk to them. It works.
Exactly.
If you're not able to speak, if you're not able to make dua, write it.
Mm-hmm.
Just write it and, you know, just give it in the form of arizah or, you know, something that we write a letter and then we put it in the flowing water and we expect that Imam really reads it.
And so, answers it back.
Yes, like kind of, you know, just make your heart lighter this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a better way to make your heart lighter. So rather than expecting someone else to be your sympathetic
ear. So this is the first thing first. So whenever you think like something is burdening your heart and you feel it's been too heavy and you need to talk to someone, the firmest wall to rely on, the best shoulder to cry on is Allah and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. Now, the people around us are important as well, but let's talk about them in the next part of today's episode. This is your program, Muslim Lady. Well, we've been talking about being a shoulder for everyone whenever they're in need. And then who's going to be my shoulder? We already talked about it, that Allah and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam are the best shoulders to cry on, are the best sympathetic ear. They would be there for you always and no matter what. And the best thing about them is that they would never let anything out of the bag of the things you have told them.
Right.
And they would never turn against you. They would never stab you in the back.
Right. One of the very important things that you have to remember over here, while you're expecting that someone should be a sympathetic ear for you, just because you were a sympathetic ear to them yesterday, you have to remember, you know, sometimes what burdens us a lot. Sometimes it's the people around us. I want to talk about this third person who has hurt me with my particular friend, like, to whom I was a sympathetic ear yesterday. It's mostly this. It's mostly you're down with the people. You have to be very careful. You should not indulge yourself in the backbiting.
Exactly.
Maybe you're just talking your heart to someone, but at the same time, when you're talking to humans, when you're talking to these people, when you're talking to the...
Because they have a brain and they would just bring things together,
no,
put the pieces together, and then they have different souls and perspectives.
As we talked about backbiting in the previous episodes, you are talking to a human being, and in front of this human being, when you open up your heart about someone, like, particular person hurt me, and now you're just trying this person to be a sympathetic ear. But at the same time, you don't realize you're backbiting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that means you're indulging yourself into sin. So you have to, you know, protect yourself from this particular thing. And you don't have to let this happen. That's the main thing.
Now, well, you know, we were talking about, we said that the best shoulders are Allah and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. But then now, as human beings, since we live among the human beings, I'd like you as my friend, for example, be my shoulder. Since I'm a living, breathing being, is it possible for me, is the good justification for me to say that, okay, since nobody is here for me, I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to stop being an ear for everyone, a free ear for everyone. Is it a good justification?
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Taba, verse number 128, لَقَدْ There certainly has come to you a messenger from among yourselves. He is concerned by your suffering, anxious for your well-being, and gracious and merciful to the believers. He's like بِالْمُؤْمِنِينَ رَعُوفٌ رَحِيمٌ بِالْمُؤْمِنِينَ رَعُوفٌ رَحِيمٌ He is gracious and merciful to the believers, which teaches us when our Prophet, peace be upon him, is taught and sent for us to be like that. He is kind towards us. He's compassionate and he's gracious towards us. It's a teaching of Quran that we have to be that way for the people. We have another hadith.
Well, by the way, just in here, as you brought up this verse from the Holy Book of Quran, I have to say that now the Prophet was like this with people who at that time, he was like this, even with the kind of people who were just the reverse of this towards him.
Exactly.
They were so unkind and so sort of hateful people who did him so much of wrong things.
Right. So, here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, did he always wanted him to be like that for the people? Like, you mentioned a very good point. People were having a very reversible action towards him. Mm-hmm. And he was still compassionate. He was still kind. He was still having that empathy. He was still sympathetic to others. He still had that sympathetic air. But how much, we are again taught in Quran, how much sympathetic air you have to be. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala again says to him in Surah Shu'ara, verse number 3, Perhaps, O Muhammad, you will kill yourself with grief. maintain a balance, O Muhammad. Again, in like we have Surah An-Naml, verse number 70, do not grieve over them, nor be distressed at their plots.
You have to have a balance, just as you mentioned. Be moderate in whatever you do. Still, when you do something good to others, do not expect them to do the same thing for you, because then you're going to get sad, because not all people are going to just think like you, because they do not have the same perspective and point of views as you, because they do not define different concepts as you do.
Right.
So not necessarily they're going to just pay back your goodnesses with the same goodnesses you expect them to do for you.
I would add a last point, which is that being sympathetic ear can be also double-edged sword sometimes. You know, you are trying to hear someone because of the Islamic teachings that you have learned, but not just listen. Consult that person. You know, give consultations, give knowledge to that person, because this person, when he or she gets habit of, you know, relying on you just to telling their troubles to you, they would always seek constant validation in their life. So try not to do that with their personality. It's vital to maintain a balance.
Yeah, exactly. That's very important to have balance. And I just said it to you. Expectation would kill us. So we should just work on ourselves to be so moderate. And at the very same time, do not have any expectations from people. So let's go for another break. And then we'll be back for the last part.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So, we know that human beings are not going to treat us the way we treat them, as in the kind things that we do to others. We talked about it already. It's not a good justification to stop being a kind person just because people are not kind with me. And I guess kindness does not work like that. When I am sympathetic toward others, I can never cease that quality to exist in me, in my personality. I cannot just take it out, make a hole in my personality and take it out and just throw it away. Yeah. No, it exists in me and it runs just like the blood runs in my blood.
Right. Is the trait of being sympathetic air good or bad? The answer is not a simple binary distinction. Yes, a good one or a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it lies in the way we navigate and embrace this quality. It's very important how you take it. What are your beliefs regarding this? How to be a sympathetic air, or how to be a, shall we have empathy or not? Like, we have one of the narrations which says that if some of the believer is in a pain, it's like you all believers are like a human body. If one
exactly.
is in pain, and your entire body should be restless. So we are not completely, the sense of empathy and being a sympathetic ear is not downplayed entirely.
Yeah, we
Islam.
Also have it in our poems. In Persian poems, we have it that the entire human beings are one body. So
they
when
one
a
body.
Part of your body aches, the entire part of your body, the whole body is going to feel the suffering.
Yes, and Muslim ummah should be like that. If we are not, then we should doubt our beliefs.
Exactly. And then you know what? I usually tell myself that whatever of kindness you're going to share to other people, be it kindness, be it sympathy, be it generosity, anything that comes to your mind as a good characteristic or trait, when you share them with other people, do it in the intention that, okay, I would love God to treat me like this as well. I am this way because I would wish God to treat me this way as well. And I guess this way, then you're not going to even expect human beings, because you expect Allah, and He would be the one who rewards you and pay you back in your rainy days.
Right. It's a beautiful attribute that can strengthen your relationships, promote healing. It could, foster a sense of community. That's very important. That's why we are said, go for a jama'at prayer, go for congregation prayer, so that we can see if someone is in suffering.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
to get to know everyone's problem.
Right, to get to know that and to be a hand of help for them. So, you know, what is important always is to maintain healthy boundaries and a balance.
Exactly.
That's what we have been talking over the episodes. So it's a quality that has the power to make a positive difference in the lives of those who live around us.
Exactly. And those people who are sympathetic ears, well, I guess they are perfect listeners and consulters, and everybody looks at them as this anchor who could shoulder many burdens and problems. So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you just enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
China and Russia have called on Washington to clarify the purpose of the U.S. military's biological weapons activities, despite its international obligations banning such programs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Sputnik news agency has covered this story and tells us more. China has censured the United States on the grounds that it is engaged in more biohazardous laboratory tests for military applications than any other country in the globe. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Friday, 18th of August, "We all know that America is the most active country in the field of biomilitary, which raises serious questions for other countries regarding Washington's true intentions." The Chinese official made the remark in response to a recent review by the Pentagon of countries posing a biological threat to the world. In the Biodefense Posture Review published on Thursday, 17th of August, the Pentagon listed China as the key long-term threat to the world, allegedly due to its development of biological weapons. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said Americans often fabricate reports on the so-called threats to deter and suppress other countries and to protect the hegemonic interests of the United States. Wang Wenbin added, "In contrast to the United States, China supports the international community in reviewing how the U.S. is complying with the Biological Weapons Convention." In April, the Chinese official had reiterated calls on the United States to faithfully observe their international obligations and provide comprehensive explanations on its military biological activities within the country and abroad. In early March 2022, the Russian Ministry of Defense released information indicating that the United States was deploying an extensive biological research program in Ukraine. According to Russia's Defense Ministry, the United States has spent more than $200 million on 46 biological laboratories in Ukraine that participate in the U.S. military biological program. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov, Chief of the Radiation, Chemical and Biological Protection Forces of the Russian Armed Forces, says one of the priority tasks of the Ukrainian laboratories was to collect and send to the United States strains of pathogens of dangerous infectious diseases, such as cholera, anthrax, tularemia, and others. Without further elaborating on the cycle, Lieutenant General Krylov said, "There is a clear trend. Pathogens that fall within the Pentagon's area of interest, such as COVID-19, bird flu, African swine fever, subsequently become a pandemic, and American pharmaceutical companies become the beneficiaries." According to Lieutenant General Krylov, the U.S. was extensively studying coronaviruses just before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. In July, the White House announced the creation of the Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy, tasked with leading, coordinating, and implementing actions related to preparedness for and response to known and unknown biological threats. Russia's TASS news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Russia's foreign minister has slammed the United States' military biological activities in the Commonwealth of Independent States, citing it as a security threat. Speaking at a recent news conference, the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov warned that there are threats of terrorism and threats posed by military biological activities in our space by the United States and its allies, which create very dangerous precedents in terms of biological security. Also, there is a direct threat to public health and the environment. Sergei Lavrov pointed out that removing dangers threatening peace and safety in the region was of utmost importance and required a joint effort. In March of 2022, the Russian State Duma and the Federation Council passed a resolution to conduct a parliamentary investigation into the biological laboratories in Ukraine. The Russian Investigating Commission concluded recently that the U.S. military is developing a universal genetically altered bioweapon comparable to that of a nuclear winter. Personnel working at these Pentagon-funded biological laboratories in Ukraine revealed the emergency disposal of particularly dangerous pathogens on 24th of February 2022, namely plague, anthrax, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. The Commission said in its report, "The possession of such highly effective biological weapons creates, in the view of the U.S. military, the real prerequisites to change the nature of contemporary armed conflicts." Prior to the start of the Russian special operation in Ukraine in late February 2022, then-U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland voiced concern over the materials developed at the biological laboratories in Ukraine. Victoria Nuland said the State Department was concerned that the Russian military may be trying to take control of them and is working with Ukraine to ensure that Kiev can prevent any of these research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces. Russia's Defense Ministry stated that, in fact, Victoria Nuland had confirmed the Pentagon's involvement in biological weapons programs in Ukraine. The Russian embassy in Armenia also said in an earlier report that there were organizations involved in biological projects in Ukraine. The Armenian government has reportedly denied the existence of the biological laboratories working in collaboration with U.S. military personnel. Chinese newspaper, the China Daily, has also covered the same story. U.S. politician Robert Kennedy Jr. has confirmed the existence of American biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, which are used to produce banned biological weapons. The Democratic Party presidential candidate, Robert Kennedy Jr., told former Fox News host Tucker Carlson in a video interview posted on the X social network, formerly known as Twitter, on Tuesday, 17th of August. He said, "We have biological laboratories in Ukraine because we're developing biological weapons there." The American politician Robert Kennedy Jr. said in the interview, "Those biological weapons are using all kinds of new synthetic biology, and CRISP, an acronym for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats in DNA, technology, and genetic engineering techniques that were not available to a previous generation." Robert Kennedy Jr. added, "When the Patriot Act reopened the biological laboratory arms race in 2001, the Pentagon began putting a lot of money into biological weapons." Robert Kennedy Jr. added, "But they were nervous at that time because if you violate the Geneva Convention, it's a hanging offense." The politician added, "So they were nervous about actually going full force into biological weapons development. So they transferred the authority for biosecurity to one agency in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services." Robert Kennedy Jr. concluded by saying, "But now, when you do bioweapons development, every biological weapon, it needs vaccines, so you develop them side by side, because in 100% of cases, when you deploy a biological weapon, there's blowback. Your side also gets sick." Russia's ambassador to the United Nations, Vasily Nebenzia, revealed that the secret U.S. laboratories in Ukraine were producing biological warfare. As a result of the illegal activities that were being carried out at U.S. biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, Russia last year asked the United Nations Security Council to establish a commission to investigate the reports that Washington and Kiev were in violation of the convention prohibiting the use of biological weapons.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran strongly condemns Israel's repeated attacks on Syria, saying regime seeks to divert global attention from its crimes against Palestinians. Bahrain extends jail terms of over a dozen political prisoners after they protest in